Carl is icing alongside us for some time. You may have heard almost every one of us quote Glenn at some point, because generally at some point before Kevin or myself or Peter or Darian preach, we generally sit down with Glenn and say, all right, tell us what we're missing in this text. Or tell us how this would have been interpreted from a historical perspective. And he's always brought a wealth of knowledge. And so last week, Glenn started us off with an introduction to the book of Ruth. At Coast Hills, our mission is to discover and follow Jesus. And we are seeking to work that out by living in gracious space, living in generous love, and being Jesus-centered. And in the book of Ruth, we are seeking to discover more about what it means to live in gracious space together. And Glenn's actually going to come and do the first chapter of the book of Ruth for us today. Again, helping us to explore in continuing ways what it means to live out gracious space together. So Glenn, why don't you come and I'll pray for you, and then we'll dive into the first chapter of the book of Ruth. Jesus, thank you for bringing Glenn and Brittany to our community. Thank you for the ways that you have gifted Glenn and the ways that he has been serving us for so long already. Thank you that you have been preparing him with the words that he has for us today. Would you walk before him and speak clearly to him and speak to our hearts through him, Jesus? We thank you. Thank you that you are leading and guiding. We ask these things in your name, Jesus. Amen. Amen.
Well, good morning. As she said, I'm Glenn Collins, and I've counted a privilege to be a part of the teaching team here. If this is your first time here, make yourself at home. We're glad to have you. If you're part of the Coast Hills family, welcome home. We are who we are because your presence adds value and helps us understand what it means to be a Jesus-centered community moving towards Christ. If you were here last week, you probably saw me do something rather special, which was I thought I'd go old school. And I did papers because I was raised in a Pentecostal church to where you're supposed to have everything memorized, you work from papers because that was more godly. And then it turns out I can't do that. I fumbled everything. I spent half the time doing this. It was beautiful. So I'm really excited about what we're doing today for the sake that what we're doing is stepping into the book of Ruth, but you'll see the title is The Story of Naomi. Because although the book is called Ruth, it's central message about the restoration of one Jewish woman who lost everything. So as we step into this, what we're asking for you to do, but what we're trying to do as we read, is to say, what would it be for Naomi? That we see ourselves in the character of Naomi, not in the amazing, benevolent, and faithful Ruth that seems to do everything above and beyond, but in the one who had so many things strike her that she lost all hope, and the one restored to the person she thought that God couldn't even exist in. And that's what we're entering into today. So if you weren't here last week, we'll do a previously on Coast Hills. We entered a metaphor for how we get to Scripture, which is Scripture is jazz. Our faith community is jazz. And when I say that, what I mean is jazz is a language. And in order to learn it, we must listen to the masters, both past and present. We analyze and we study what they have done so that we can step into, because they say the musician lives in a living now harmony that interacts with the improvisational context of their actual life. It's not a matter of having a right or wrong note, but it's learning how to interact with the notes that are played. I would take that to say for the Christian, that we immerse ourselves in the story by listening to the biblical text, both masters old and new, that we study and analyze, that the Christian will live in a real-time, improvisational nature, because it's about a God who exists with us. It's about a life that can come now. So this week, we're going to go through three distinct phases for this sermon. Like last week, we're going to connect to one thing from our tradition that is beautiful, which is called Lectio Divina. If you haven't heard it, it comes from the tradition to say that God exists within his word in such a way that the most beautiful thing we can do is sit in the story and God will speak through the text itself. So we'll start with going over the text twice because we get a privilege with such a short book. We can actually read the full text. And then we'll step into the analyze and study moment. We're going to go through a few exegetical or literary notes on the text in order to set up that this live improvisational rift to where we can dream about, talk about what is it for us to go into gracious space. And today I would say, what good is gracious space when your life falls apart? That's the thrust of Ruth chapter 1. So to start, Electra Divina, if you haven't done it before, it's not a matter of you being able to repeat the story, but to say that God speaks to us through the story. So listen for a phrase that jumps out to you. Listen for a word, a moment that you can say, this is God interacting with us, because that is the sole belief of this community, is that we exist and we move because God is with us, which gives us the courage to improv when we're not sure what to do. So in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab. He and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahon and Chilion. They were Ephraites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. She was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, the name of the other Ruth. When they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and husband. Then she started to return with her daughter-in-law from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had considered Israel his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she had been living, her and her two daughter-in-laws, and they went on their way to go back to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughter-in-laws, go back, each one of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find security, each of you, in the house of your husband. Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud. They said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Do I still have sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your own way, for I am too old to have a husband. Even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I should have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you then wait until they are grown? Would you then refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me. They wept aloud again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So she said, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. May the Lord do thus to me, or do thus and so to me, and more as well, if even death parts me from you. When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women said, is this Naomi? She said to them, call me no longer Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me? The Almighty has brought calamity upon me. So Naomi returned together with Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, who came back with her from the country of Moab. They came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Hogan. What word jumped out? What phrase? What moment? Try to hold that in your mind. And we'll go through this passage one more time. Then we're going to walk through it together. So again, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab. He and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife, Naomi. The names of his two sons were Malchon and Chilion. They were Ephraites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. She was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah. The name of the other, Ruth. When they had lived there about 10 years, both Malchon and Chilion also died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Then she started to return with her daughter-in-law from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had considered his people and given them food. She set out from the place where she had been living, she and her two daughter-in-laws. They went on their way to go back to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to each of her daughter-in-laws, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find security, each of you, in the house of your husband." Then she kissed them and they wept aloud. They said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Do I still have sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. Even if I should have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you wait until they are grown? Would you then refrain from marrying? No, my daughters. It has been far more bitter for me than it has for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me." They wept aloud again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not press me to leave you or turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your gods my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me, and more as well, if even death parts me from you." When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. The women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Call me no longer Naomi. Call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me? The Almighty has brought calamity upon me." So Naomi returned with Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, who came back with her from the country of Moab. They came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Again, any phrases or moments that stood out, just hold those in mind. Because throughout Christian tradition, we believe that God speaks to us through the text. And now we're going to walk through a little bit of what happened within this text so that we can try to get some grounds for how do we rift. Now you'll notice in verse 1 to 2 that Naomi's introduced from a somewhat elevated position. She has a husband and two sons, and I don't know how much you know of ancient cultures, but for a woman, you didn't reach full womanhood until you gave birth to a son. That's how you knew you had arrived. That's when you had value, you had place, and actually your entire social position was tied to the men in your life. So Elimelech, you later find out, is related to Boaz, so they come from a central family in the community. And the two male sons, marks her as successful. But then it comes to the ironic moment. She's driven from Bethlehem, which would be the house of bread, which is a common name in Israel for any place that produces crops. So because of famine, they left the house of bread, her and her two sons. And this is where it foreshadows that ominous things are happening. Because the names used for the sons aren't common names. The names used for the sons, you have the first one, Mahon, is sickness. The second one, Chalon, is destruction. So the way the story starts is Elimelech, which be God is my king, and Naomi, which means sweetness. So God is my king and sweetness have a child of sickness and destruction who have to flee the land of bread because of famine. You can tell they're setting up this fall. And within the Jewish narrative, this is something, if you guys read through the historical books, here's a key to understanding how a character is developed. Look at their first words, the first exchanges, because that frames who the person is. And especially for the wives, the women are often framed by their first interaction with their soon-to-be husbands. And so you get the dialogue pattern back and forth to say, is she virtuous? Does she work hard? And so this introduces Naomi when you come into the section that's 7 to 18. 8 to 13 introduces the first time she speaks. And for her first words were blessing. She said, may God show, it says kindness. This is one of the few times you'll ever hear me use original languages because the translators are smarter than me. They usually do better. But it's chesed, which is used multiple times for the book of Ruth, which has to do with a relational faithfulness. When you have chesed, it means you're doing right by. So it gets translated as kindness, good works, faithfulness, loving kindness, covenantal faithfulness. But it has to do with this interpersonal relationship. And so Naomi says, may God show this kind of marital covenantal faithfulness to you that you've showed to my sons and to me. She said, may you find security, because in this time, women did not have security outside of the family they were married to. She said, may you go back to your people and actually have food to eat and a good life to live. But then as soon as they weep and say, no, don't make us go, her voice changes. And she says, you don't understand. The hand of the Lord is against me. She said, I have lost all hope. Like, could I give you a child that our family could prosper? No. I'm too old for any good thing to happen. I am cursed to be a widow and hope someone gives me a handout. And that's where she goes to the phrase, when it says the hand of the Lord is against her, it's actually a pretty emphatic saying, because it comes to the point of saying, God has attacked me. It's actually that point of saying the difference between, you know, someone's kind of angry with me to they jumped me. This would be more in line of God jumped me. This came out of the blue. He hurt me. What hope do I have if even God strikes me? But then Ruth does something beautiful. In 16 to 17, something I'd want you to notice, because a lot of times within our own narratives, we think if you come to God, then you go to people. Ruth's pledge is to Naomi. God doesn't come for three stanzas. She said, do not drive me from you. I will journey with you. I will live with you. I will live and die at your hand. If even death has the power to separate me, may God judge me for it. So her promise is an irrational commitment to the person in front of her. And it's at that point when it says, Naomi says she sees she's determined. Think of more, you're arguing with your 13-year-old, and you know it's a no-win. You're like, okay, you're going to do something dumb. I can't stop you. I've tried to stop you, but this is happening. If you look at the back row, the very seasoned, peppered gentleman with an oversized goatee, that's my father. He usually ended these conversations with, well, go ahead and try it, boy. Because it was usually around construction or diving or something. I was like, Dad, I can make this jump. He's like, I wouldn't if I were you. And that would go about three rounds, go ahead and try it. And when he said, go ahead and try it, I usually knew, this is dumb. Somehow this is going to hurt. That's where Naomi is. She's like, fine. My lot is hopeless. God has struck me. I have nothing to offer you. Go ahead and try, boy. And then she comes into the town, and notice how her language gets stronger. Because as she comes into the town, her first words you see that define her is blessing. May God show you the faithfulness, the chesed, the kindness, the generosity that you showed me and my sons. Then immediately she goes to, really, I have no hope. God has struck me. Now she starts with, when the women see her, this poem does a play on words. It says the women see her because you're coming into a small town. This isn't like going into Vancouver. This is more like going to Fort Langley. So people know you arrived. This is more like my hometown. When I go back to visit, getting milk from the grocery store is a 45-minute event. Because they're like, oh, Glenn, where have you been? We've seen your dad. Let us regale you with 25 stories of your family. I was like, I know all of these. I live them. Thank you. And so the women see her, and they say, could this be Naomi? And her answer is, don't call me Naomi. Don't call me sweetness, for I am Mara. Mara is bitterness. Naomi rhymes with the term for sweetness. She said, you can't call me sweet. I become bitter. I hate things. She said, the Lord has dealt harshly with me because I left full. I had security. I had a family. I had things to depend on. Now I have nothing. I'm a widow in the market hoping to take care of me. She said, the Almighty, which the term there would be related to the mountain gods. The reason that's important is because of how she's naming her reality. She's saying, do you know who God is? God is the angry being on top of the mountain that if you disobey, he strikes you. God is a war God that would just as soon cut your throat as extend you grace in this moment because his rule is absolute. That's how she's saying, this is the story of my God. And the women of Bethlehem, this is what I kind of love, because also remember in verse 6, you had that moment to where it said, and God considered his people. She has just lost everything. Her inheritance, her husband, her family, any idea. There's no social safety nets. Her children were her social safety net. So think of you losing your savings account, then someone writing you and saying your 401k just got trashed too. And she goes to a land that just experienced God's blessing. The famine's over. It's harvest time. So while she's there speaking this, she's speaking to a people who've just experienced God's blessing, and none of the characters challenge Naomi. No one says, that's not the God we know. Look at the harvest. No one says, you're wrong. You're mistaken. That's not how you should talk about God. They do something that it's a faithful presence. It's a practice in Jewish culture that I think is one of the greatest things I've ever heard of. It's called sitting Shiva. When a huge tragedy happens in your life, if you've read the book of Job, his friends come and sit around him until he speaks. That's the idea. You come with people who are mourning and tragic, and you sit with them in their pain. You don't fix it. And so, just after this scene, to where the women say, we can't even recognize you. You've come back so distraught, so low, so pain. You've aged 10 years. Could this be the woman we knew? And she said, no, for I'm bitter. Then it switches at the end. The narrator comes back in verse 22. And I love the narrator in Ruth. If you have anyone to fanboy the narrator. He's awesome. And it's probably a he. Because like any good lover, you don't scream in the face of the person you're dating. You lean in and you whisper. Anything that's truly beautiful, that is impactful, loses some of its charm and potency if you scream it. But the subtlety in verse 22 is mirroring the mention in verse 6, to where in verse 6, God considered his people. And this woman who lost all hope, lost all security, doesn't know how she's going to eat. And the narrator says, and they arrived just so happens to be just before the harvest, the time of the most plentiful area of that village. Everyone would be partying and celebrating. Food would be plentiful. That ends the section of how does the narrative move forward. So we're going to now say, let's rift. What do we do? Because let's face it, most of us don't live on farms. Our inheritance and our security doesn't come from did you have a child or not. So the story of Naomi begins in a tragic fall into despair. All the beauty she found in life and the comfort she found in her understanding of God brought her to this point, but it was not the story that could carry her forward. So we have watched her move from full to empty, from whole to brokenness, from sweet to bitter. And I'd ask, have you ever experienced a moment like this? A moment when life destroys everything you thought you knew, and the only thing that can come out of your mouth is this embittered cry of, even God has struck me. What good is gracious space when your entire life falls apart? Well, first, I'd say if we're looking at, because remember, we're telling the story of Naomi. Naomi gives us permission to name our experience and fall apart. She names her reality. She comes in and says, you know what my reality is? Do you know what I've experienced of God? God is a heavy-handed tyrant who stripped everything I ever loved out of my life. She says this to people who have just experienced the blessing, like I said. She goes so far as to say, not only has God attacked me, but God made me bitter. Not only was he bitter, he dealt with me harshly. Not only did he deal with me harshly, he brought all the calamity and struggle that you see in my life is laid at his door. God did this to me. And at this moment, often, at least if you come from a similar tradition as me, we get scared in these moments. We're like, are you going to lose your faith? If you lean into, if you name this reality and actually your true experience, will we lose our faith? Will we no longer trust God? But I would want to say, if you've ever got to read Derrida on his treatise on forgiveness, a lot of people ask this kind of question just after World War II. And the saying that became common in philosophy was forgiveness died in Auschwitz. Because at something so atrocious as something so brutal as a concentration camp, there was no realm for forgiveness. And Derrida was a Jewish-French philosopher who lived during World War II, so this is a real question for him. And he spoke in a lecture a few years later and said, we misunderstand the Holocaust if we think forgiveness died there. For only in the faith of that is which is truly terrible can you have forgiveness. He said, forgiveness did not die in Auschwitz, it was born there. And I'd say in the same way, when you come into these moments, actually name your reality, it's okay, you won't lose your faith. And Coast Hills, as a community of gracious space, we want to be that place for you that you don't have to give us a right answer, that your faith can be born from the conflict of thinking God struck you. And that we can say in our doubt, in our moment of pain, in these circumstances we don't understand, was the birth of our faith. And this space is violated by easy cliche answers. And the reason I say violated is because when somebody's life is falling apart, at least when I've experienced it, because I've had a colorful history, do you know what cliche answers do? They distance you. You're no longer sitting with the person. You're not doing Naomi's or Ruth's pledge of, I will walk with you, I'll live with you, I'll eat with you, I'll die with you. You say, you know what? You lost a child. God must have needed an angel. Everything happens for a reason. Don't you know God's still good? And that allows the person speaking to distance from the pain. We've closed it. It's answered. It absolves us of responsibility. At least I can know when I've used those sayings, because I have. It allows me to say, your pain is yours, and I can kind of walk over here, because that's icky. But this is not the space for that. To name somebody's reality and to be gracious space is to give them space to name their reality. And like the women of Bethlehem, it is not our job to correct. It's not our job to say, if you only saw it right, it'd be okay. It is our job to witness and to sit with them. And then I'd say the next thing we could riff from, what is good is gracious space when life falls apart. Naomi asks us to let people walk with us. Now, it has been noted by psychologists that negative emotions, depressing, trauma, usually cause us to insulate and to isolate. We pull away relationally from people we've known, And I've actually experienced this a bit because through my life, depression has played a large role. When depressive moments hit, you come into a negative cycle of, if I can get farther away from you and just into myself, it's a safe and protected area. And you see this in the text. What happens after there's the trauma? She loses her children, her husband. The daughter-in-law she had for 10 years, she said, please go away. There's no hope in being around me. That move of isolation isn't always one that you dislike other people. You're trying to save them from yourself. You don't realize I'm a train wreck. I'm cancer. If I touch it, it dies. There's no hope for me left. Just go away, save yourself. But Naomi asks us, as a people of gracious space, when life is falling apart, to let someone journey with you. Because even after her acceptance of Ruth's oath, she gives a passive response of, I can't stop you. It is precisely Ruth's irrational commitment, her faithful presence, that the narrators point to when they say Ruth has been restored to community. Now, I'd like to say something for this point, just for the sake that sometimes when we hear irrational commitment, it can put us into a negative space. Because we can say, okay, irrational commitment, you can't say no, you can't take your time. But I'd say within this, that since it can be a gamble to let someone journey with us, to trust their irrational commitment, it is a healthy step of faith for us to intentionally move towards the other. But what this irrational commitment means, irrational commitment can only be given, not demanded. So be careful. If you come into a spot, this is where I've seen the most chaos happen in a church, is we flip the roles. When we're sitting in Naomi's place, we demand irrational commitment as opposed to receive what somebody offered. Because when it's offered, when it's given, that can be healthy and life-giving. When it is a requirement for you to give me irrational commitment or you are out, kind of a red flag. And then into the other part, irrational commitment, intentionality does not mean immediately. Even in the text, Naomi begrudgingly accepts, but you do not see until chapter 3 to where Naomi does anything to try to secure position. She sits, she receives, she witnesses what is irrational commitment. And that's what I'd invite us to, what it means to let someone walk with you. It doesn't mean you share everything that's ever happened to you with every person you meet. It means that you learn the relationships you can trust, and you have the faith that when someone says they're for you, you can depend on it, which is the nature of a gracious space. I'd say this is how it happened for me. I titled this story, The Summer from Hell, Death, Debt, and Destruction. As you can tell, it's a light summery Saturday afternoon movie. During this summer, it was towards the last year of my undergrad. Now, as any good Pentecostal child that I was, I asked the one question everyone does in undergrad Bible college, God, should I marry this person? Because if you haven't been to a Christian college, everyone is very hormonal and attracted to each other. But you get at least 3 lectures a semester about how sex is bad. No to sex. So everyone's highly hormonal, very committed to the next stage of what ministry could be, and celibate, which creates a lot of people making strong commitments to each other after 3 days. And so I met this beautiful woman from Japan. She obviously was the sun and moon and starlit sky. And we had been going. I was like, God, should I marry this person? And this is what happened. A woman in the church came up to me and said, I've been watching you two. You're charming. I was like, yay me. She says, I'd like you to have this. She gave me a 0.65 carat SG1 quality diamond, which I had appraised at about $2,000 for that diamond. I was like, well, if that's not a sign, I don't know what is. She said, let me introduce you to a jeweler. I go to the jeweler, and I see this one band. It's simple. It's elegant. It's everything I'm not. And I point to it and say, I like that one. Turned out to be platinum. That's expensive. And he picked it up. I picked it up. I was like, okay. Then I saw a price tag fall. It was $1,850. And it went from light, and I could flip it to, thank you. And he's like, well, you're a friend of the woman who just gave me the ring. He's like, what were you thinking of spending on a ring? And me and all my savings, like, I have $500. He said, okay. You can have the $1,800 band for $500. I was like, obviously, God. And then it even goes farther. Obviously, this charming moment is not this wife because this is an ex. And it ends terribly since it's the summer from hell. So I get this next moment that I was able to set up between my school in Japan, which is where she was from and where we were planning on moving to if we ever got together, a relationship between my school and theirs. So I was able to setting up a third year course in Japan for the summer. People came together to sponsor me. A church I used to attend said, yes, we'll help foot the bill. I am just pulling aces. And this, in that beautiful moment of being so high, is when I took a 20-foot dive into the ground and just split my head open. It was tragic. Because I go to Japan, everything's great. I propose to her in the middle of the emperor's palace, which I was later told that was dumb. But I thought it was charming. And so she says yes. We announce to everyone we're getting married. We come back to Hawaii, where I find out that my cousin just committed suicide, that I'd lived next to for a few years. I'm like, oh, wow. 3 days later, there's a bit of tension. We have this coming to Jesus moment conversation to where she takes the ring and says, I can't keep this. And she hands me back the ring. I was like, okay, cool. Then, the church that said they would sponsor me came into some conflict with family of mine and pulled their funds. So I suddenly found out I had a $2,500 bill. I was like, oh, okay. The next day, my other cousin committed suicide. Within a week, I had got a $2,500 bill, an engagement ring handed back to me, two cousins commit suicide, and I found myself at a place of such distraught that only God could have struck me, staring at my Greek textbook, doing the same paragraph for an hour before I realized I had done the same paragraph for an hour. And this is what saved me. This is what rescued me. This is what helped me come forward. Because some people gave me pat answers. It was awesome. I was walking through the church I worked at, and this gentleman who liked me, he's a good brother, came and said, Glenn, don't worry. There's somebody better for you. And since I'm married, yes, absolutely, it completely worked out that way. But in that moment, I was like, what do you mean better? Like, are you saying she was ugly, unintelligent, ungodly? He's like, no. I was like, then why would you come to me in this moment when I'm trying to wipe tears off my face and tell me, don't worry, it's better? Because that caused distance. The people who saved me was Carl, who Aaron had spoke of. Carl, Mike Vilsted, and Will Kapahu would hit me up randomly and say, hey, it's been rough. Do you want to go shoot pool? Do you want to talk over a beer, a coffee, go for a walk? Carl was a little more insistent because he knew that I would be more isolationist. And he called and said, I'm at your house. You don't have a choice. I'm picking you up. He's like, so we're catching a movie. We're getting a book. We're doing something that gets you moving. And it was a month of that helped me move through one of the most painful, dark moments of my life. It was difficult to trust their irrational commitment to me in a time when everything fell apart. But that's what gracious space is. You can name your reality, you can fall apart completely, and then you can step in a movement of hope to say that these people who say they're connected to me, I can lean on them. And that would come to our last point, which is Naomi calls us. Because remember, the first one was Naomi gives us permission to name our reality and to fall apart. Second was Naomi asked us to let people come along for the journey. And this, Naomi calls us to become the home people can return to and to come home. Within the story of Naomi, Bethlehem represents home. This is a place of her relatives, her people, and ultimately the closest thing to a social safety net that existed in that time period. Reading post-resurrection, we would now define ourselves as people of Christ. Do you know why Christians meet weekly? It's actually an anomaly historically. It was because they had said that we weren't a client base to where we pay to God to be good. It was actually a congregational base, which is a different style of religion. And they came weekly to remember that bloodlines did not define family. That you look across and us gathering, us being a Jesus-centered people, defined what it meant to have family loyalty. So if we're looking at the story of Naomi returning home, first I would say that within the story, coming home lets you be known, and becoming home lets you know somebody else. That this is the tension we're caught in. We are coming home because we all need people. We are becoming home because we're a gracious space expanding to engulf more people. Becoming home acknowledges that we cannot do this alone. The idea of Christianity, the idea of faith, the idea of gracious space when life falls apart is the base notion that we need each other. Becoming home acknowledges that the beauty of another person is not what they can give us, but the fact that they can be a part of us. Coming home, even in despair or doubt, is an event of profound faith. Because faith isn't always being able to say the right statements for a test. We're not doing a lecture here so that you understand the exegetical and historical norms of the book of Ruth in such a way that at the end of these 5 weeks, I can hand out a test and you're like, I know how this paradigm breaks down. That would be pointless, honestly. I mean, it helps. I love it. I've spent the last decade in school. It's awesome. But the point for us here as a faith community is that as we move towards each other, even in doubt, even when we say, I don't know if I can completely trust you, I'm hesitant, like Naomi, I will accept this begrudgingly, waiting for you to say, yeah, I really should tap out. It's that step that is still faith. Because faith is born in doubt at times, as even in doubt, we move towards each other. Becoming home means that you create that space for the other person. People won't always trust you, they won't always trust your intentions, and they shouldn't. We're human and we do a lot of dumb things. However, we extend grace in such a way to allow them to completely name the reality, not correct it. We extend grace in such a way that they begin to trust that we'll walk with them. And that we become this dynamic community of being home and coming home together. So that we can affect more people, because just like Ruth, the pledge we make is not simply to God. It's not simply to Jesus. But if you look at the Gospels, if you look at the New Testament, all the writers said, if you want to pledge your allegiance to Christ, you must pledge it to his body. If you want to love God, you must love his people. That we're still caught in that movement, that dynamic reality of relationship. That to move closer to God will draw me intrinsically closer to you. To move closer to you, I can understand the beauty of God that I would not have known otherwise. And that's how I'd like to close this first chapter. That even when life falls apart, listen to that subtle whisper. That it says there's hope in all this pain and the reality that you believe God has struck you in the story that God is ready to judge and drop a hammer when things happen. There is hope. It's harvest time. And I'd like to extend a promise that as long as Coast Hills exist together as a community, you'll have space to name your reality without fear that if you get the answer wrong, someone's going to correct it, but we want to sit in each other's reality. And that we'll do our best to walk alongside each other despite what the circumstances are. And that in this, it'll be a beautiful event. And so as we come into communion, this actually works well, because next week it's going to be a different movement, because this is the first setting of Ruth. The next movement, it's fun. But we get to come to communion. I'm not sure who's doing communion right now, but communion is amazing because I don't know if you know it, but Christianity developed over the first 300 years to have different theological statements. However, something that is truly unique, that no matter what the theological statements were, every single community had baptism and communion, and all of them had a liturgy to recognize that when we gather around this, we're not drinking judgment into ourselves to say, look, have I sinned? At least in the first century or two, what communion was coming and saying, this is Christ's body. And we declare at this moment, even if we don't see it in reality, that this community, these people, this is our family, for better or for worse. That even if we don't see it in this moment, that we pledge by the concept of Jesus, the resurrected one, that God's kingdom will be here as we learn to come and to become home. So whoever is doing communion, because I did not read that whole call sheet. And are we going to do benediction at the end, or should we do now?
Okay.
So at Coast Hills, our tradition is to do communion together on the first Sunday of every month. And as Glenn said, it is a continuous reminder of the presence of Jesus with us. And one of the miraculous things about when Jesus gave us this sacrament of communion is the people that he had sitting around the table. And every one of those people sitting around the table were broken in some significant way. And yet it was to them and to us that he gave this gift of remembering again that his body was broken and his blood was shed. It's our practice that during communion, you'll come forward, you'll take the bread, and you'll dip it in the cup, and then you can go back to your seat, and you can take, and you can eat whenever you're ready. We also have a practice of, while we're singing, Kim will lead us in a song of worship, that we will pass baskets specifically for our community care fund. All this money goes to help people in our community or members of our congregation in times of tragedy or specific need that arise suddenly. So I'll pray for us. I'll pray for the elements as well. And then we invite you to come and take and eat and know again in a very concrete way the presence of our Lord with us. Jesus, thank you for the witness of Naomi. Thank you for her honesty. Thank you that you invite us, Jesus, to sit around your table no matter what's going on. We thank you for this bread, and we thank you for this cup. We thank you for your broken body. We thank you for your shed blood. We thank you that you are alive and that you are with us while we eat around this table together. We bless you, Jesus. Jesus.